As you can tell by my accent, I'm American, but kind of a strange American because I was born in the Philippines, grew up in Denver, Colorado, lived in Germany for 10 years, and then in the Czech Republic for the last 28 years. So I just say I have an American accent, but I have a European soul and heart. I spent most of my life actually around here, and so this is what I call home. There are a lot of teachers in this room, so this is going to be a great time together because we'll be learning together. And, well, by the way, before I go a little bit further, let me also introduce you to my family. So this is my family, taken just 2 weeks ago. So I'm a grandfather. How is that possible? So I have three kids, two boys there, and then a daughter who's all the way on the end, and then five grandkids and one on the way. They're all serving God here in Europe. So on the far left, they're in Albania. And then my son in the middle is doing a theological education program in the Czech Republic. My daughter's also, there's my wife right there. So that's us. I serve with a ministry called Josiah Venture. And this is our vision, is a movement of God among the youth of Central and Eastern Europe that finds its home in the local church and transforms society. So we're all about reaching young people, training young leaders, and seeing that happen through the local church. We have staff in all of these countries. So if you're in one of those countries, some Josiah Venture staff are serving in those places. And so if you're interested in how to build strong youth ministries in local churches, please come and talk to me about that. I'd love to share more about how those teams can help you. This is the Josiah Venture team. So we have 350 on our team. Serving in those, and we also have a training center just right across the mountain, so I drove about an hour to get here, and that's at our training center there. So that's just a little bit about me, and our mission is to equip young leaders, fulfill Christ's commission through the local church. So I really care about teaching, and about teaching that brings transformation, like many of you do. And what would happen if we got started here, and Steve Thrall from France, who now lives in Normandy. I haven't seen Steve in a long time, but if he came and he said, "Oh, Dave, I just got to tell you, I'm a little tired because we had some of our team and we just kind of went out into the mountains here to get a team retreat. We've had so much going on, we wanted to get away, and we were just up there in one of the meadows, and all of a sudden I heard all this noise, and I saw through the trees people just started coming up, and there were 20 of them, and then 40, and then 50, and pretty soon we lost count. Someone said 5,000." So I don't know if that was really true. We were just trying to get away with our team. And all these people showed up, and I had to start teaching. And so I taught them for an hour, and then I taught them for two, and then they said they want more. And then it was, we couldn't even send them home. So I'm just a little tired today, so just forgive me, you know. Okay, so we'll forgive you. And then Laszlo from Budapest, he says, you know, I'm also a little tired too because last night a member of parliament visited me. It was about 10 o'clock. He wanted to come at night so no one else could see him. And he had some questions about the kingdom of God and about eternal life. And we talked till way at night. And so I got here really late. I'm sorry. I'm kind of tired. So we'll forgive you for that. And then Sarah chimes in and she says, well, you know, I was teaching a Bible study at my house in London. And there was a group there and they were, and pretty soon the whole room was full and people were looking in the windows, and then I couldn't teach because there's this noise on the roof. And pretty soon I noticed that it's plaster falling off the roof. That happens a lot in London, but I just didn't think it happened in my house. And then we realized someone's trying to get through the roof because they wanted to be in the center of the teaching instead of on the side. And so I'm just wondering if we could take up an offering to help fix my roof today. So, you know, what would happen if we started like that? Now, those are all kind of made up stories, but they're all real stories, right? Because there was a teacher whose teaching was so powerful that people chased him out into the wilderness and then stayed all day. They visited him at night and kept him up at night. They dug through roofs to get closer to his teaching. And why was he so powerful in his teaching? You know, we could study pedagogy. We could study the greatest preachers of various days. But really, the person we need to study is Jesus and his teaching, right? He never wrote a book, he never started a seminary, he never began an organization, no formal school, but his followers remembered what he said so well that they wrote it down word for word, and we're still studying it today. So Jesus was a master teacher, the best the world has ever known. And it's interesting to me that we often study the teachings of Christ, but we don't study the teaching methods of Christ, and that's what we're going to try to do today and tomorrow. And see, why did he, well, of course, he was the Son of God. He did miracles, right? Well, Maybe we can't do all of that, but could we learn to teach like him? And you'll find that if we teach like Jesus, oh, there he is, walking up to the hill. And if you teach like Jesus, people will remember. They remembered what he said. They remembered what he said, and different ones of it wrote it down, and they wrote it down the same. So they remembered what he said. Now, let me just ask a question. How many of you remember the topic of the sermon in your church if you didn't preach it? Okay, it's not, you can't, no cheating if you preach it. So the topic of the sermon in your church last week, raise your hand. Okay, some of you do. All right, a couple of you. So, Robert, what was it? The topic. Okay, we're going to see really if he remembers. Test time, yeah. Letter to Titus. Okay. What was an important point from that message? See, he didn't know he was going to be tested, right? So you have to think about it. All right. Now, one of the things they say that actually general people in church, only 20 to 30% of them even remember the topic that was preached on last Sunday. And then if we would ask the question, did you do anything differently this week because of the message you heard, the number drops even lower. Think of the hundreds of messages we hear that go in one ear and out the other. All of the information that goes through us. What would happen if people remembered what we said, and also if they responded? And that's also what you find in Jesus is some of them responded in anger. They picked up rocks to stone him and they ran away. But they didn't remain inert. Something happened when Jesus taught. People did something. They had to do something. What would happen if when we taught, people remembered what we said and they did something about it afterwards? Now, about 20 years ago, so this was quite a while ago, I finished up a master's in education and then began serving here in Europe, and just started thinking about, well, I've studied a lot about the great educators. What if I studied Jesus more? So I took the Sermon on the Mount as kind of a master sermon, right? It may have been a compilation of various sermons, but that's the sermon that's given to us by the writers of Scripture as his master sermon. And then compared it. I recorded 3 Czech sermons. I serve in the Czech Republic, typical sermons in a Czech church, and then compared them. And my question was, how does Jesus' sermon differ from the classical sermons we're using today? That's going to be one of our questions. How is his teaching different? And there were 5 things that he did differently, and he did them a lot, and a lot of the preachers today don't even do them at all. That was the thing that stood out to me, is the secrets Jesus used. Not only did he use them well, but there are some secrets that we hardly use at all. So that's what we're going to be talking about, is what were the secrets of Jesus' teaching method that we can find in the Sermon on the Mount, and how could we learn them so that we could teach in a way that people would respond and remember. Now, you might say, well, you know, that was Jesus, right? I mean, we can't teach like Jesus did. But have you ever heard a teacher that just captures your attention? You don't have to work at it, but you remember what they said, and it burrows into you. Think about it all week, and you have to do something about it. I remember when I was studying at Bible college. I studied at a school called Multnomah Bible College in Portland, Oregon, and we had church every day. And not only did we study theology and Bible in our classes, we also had chapel every single day, which those speakers had a real challenge because they've got students who are busy, right? And they have to go to this chapel service. Some of them were wonderful. Some of them were very boring, but it just came at you every day. And I remember one day that I usually tried to listen, but one day I went, I've got a test next hour, right after chapel. I'm not ready for it. I decided before I went into chapel that I was not going to pay attention to what the preacher said. You know, sometimes you decide in the middle. I decided before it began. So I came up and we came in the door. We had chapel in this kind of old church that was this long rectangular building, high ceilings, pews just straight as can be the whole way back. And it held about 1,500 people. Our student body was about 600, which means there's always lots of empty pews. And so I came in the door. Now, when you came in the door, you had to be there. So you had to find the person with your name and sign off that you were in chapel. because you couldn't skip. So I found that person, I signed my name, and then I went to the very back of the room. So a lot of people sat up in front, and then there was this long, about, you know, well, 600 people, what is that, about another 600-700 pews that were empty. And then I took the one on the very back, right up against the wall. Lots of space. I spread out my books. I turned sideways, you know, took off my shoes, kind of settled in right there. Okay, I'm going to study. And I start studying. They've got a little worship going, and it's a long ways away, way up there, you know, a little worship, yeah, some announcements. And then this guy gets up to speak, and he stands behind the podium. And this is the first thing he says. He says, "Students, if you're planning on taking notes today, put your pens down, because you'll never forget what I'm going to say." He's pretty arrogant, right? I mean, I got studying to do. So I started, and then he starts in, and I keep going like, I'm trying to study. He keeps interrupting my study. Way, way up there, this little guy, 1,500 seats away, pews, and I couldn't concentrate. Pretty soon, he had me, my attention gripped. I put my head in my hands and listened to him the whole way through. I could not study. And I remember till today what he said, and it changed my life. And I wanted not to listen. So his name was Bruce. What did Bruce do differently than most preachers? How could we, what did Jesus do differently than most preachers? And how can we learn to preach more like Jesus did? So you ready? Ready to go? Okay, are we ready? All right, great, great. So you've got some notes, and we'll also be working through these notes as we go. There are five secrets. Here's the first one, the secret of tension. The secret, they don't teach you this in Bible school, right? The secret of like produce tension. No, good teachers take away all the tension, right? They don't produce any tension. But actually educators, well, this is what Jesus did. Jesus used tension to capture people's attention, to make them think, and help them remember. Tension to capture people's attention, to make them think, and help them remember. You can't make a horse drink, but you can put salt in his food, right? So you can do that. Let's kind of see the Sermon on the Mount here. So you might want to open the Sermon on the Mount so you can read it, because it's a little hard to read up here on the screen. But let's try to see what he's doing as he starts the sermon. So they walk up the hill, and he sits down. I don't know if they sat down, but he was sitting down, because you always sat down to teach back then. So he sat down, and he went up on the mountain, he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Okay, now think through the grid of tension. Do you see any tension in this passage? Like, where do you see tension as he jumps into this sermon? Okay, this is opposite of what, like what would be opposite of what you might expect?
Well, listen, poor people who mourn, the meek, the hungry, not the powerful.
Yeah, we don't want to be like any of those. We want to be the happy, it says happy, I'll be if I cry. Well, how does that work? Okay, it's not what we expect. What else do you see there? What else kind of produces a little tension? What?
Repetition.
Okay, how would that produce tension? Okay, it stays in mind. So there's kind of a cadence there, yeah. Okay, someone else, yeah.
You just said something, and some of it is very counterintuitive, very much against the...
Counterintuitive, right. And how much time does he spend explaining what he just said? I mean, he does it. He just like boom, boom, boom. Let's move on, boom. Like, could you stop and tell me what you mean? Because I'm a little lost right here. Yeah, sir. Yeah, so I might hear that. Wait, you're saying that I'll be comforted, but I don't feel comforted. So how could that be true, what you're saying? Someone else, yeah.
I was just thinking how you went up the mountain, you got weights, he's going up and then he sits down. It's almost like this tensionless weight.
Right.
This is the crowd, then he drags off the mountain. Or I don't know how long it took.
Right, yeah. Okay, so anything, any other observations about what could be tension producing? Yeah.
Well, blessed is what the people want to be. The categories he describes are what they don't want to be. And then at the end, suddenly it's not just these people out there, it's suddenly you.
Right.
So he's building with people thinking in the third party, and then he finishes the whole thing off and saying, and actually, the worst of all of them is you if you're going to follow me.
Right, and by the way, it'll be great if people revile you and persecute you and utter all these kinds of evil. So, oh, this sounds wonderful. Wait, I thought you were going to tell me why it's good to follow you. It sounds like it's bad to follow you. So if you just said how many tension producing statements are in this, you know, you could go like there. You could say maybe blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. But maybe it's even more than that. Maybe it's even, we'll pick those up too, because he goes through them so fast that I'm just going, wait, I don't quite understand. You're just kind of drilling me with these things that you're creating disequilibration. By the way, that's one of the things that educators say is necessary for learning is an appropriate amount of disequilibration. Because if I have to fight a little bit, I'm going to remember more what was said. Now here's a little bit farther on. Tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now look what he does. I mean, you've heard what it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. Never murderers will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. And whoever insults his brothers will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the fire of hell. Like, slow down here. Wait a minute. I mean, now you got me arguing with me, because I'm thinking, have I ever said you fool? Does he mean this literally or figuratively? How? And he's saying, unless my righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, they're at the top. So if the people at the top can't make it, how can I? I mean, this is, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with a lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it. I mean, he is just like, bzzz. That's not all the sermon. But it's quite a bit of, he's winding things up here. Why is he doing this? Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about, but he does it a lot more maybe than, there's kind of this holy tone that preachers are supposed to have. We need to be very nice, right? And just talk in this wonderful, soothing tone that helps everyone go to sleep as fast as possible. This sounds really provocative when he gets into it. Wow. So tension, a number of modern educators believe that creating perplexity, unrest, and doubt in the students is essential as a prelude to learning. Interesting, huh? Or learning involvement is at its best when learner perplexity is just short of frustration. When people feel a positive sense of dissatisfaction, they will think harder and reflect more deeply. So if I want to teach like Jesus, I actually have to be willing to stir some disequilibration, create some tension, so that people learn and remember. Well, there are several ways to use it. One was to capture people's attention. We're going to look out at some other passages too as we go along. Let's look at John 3, which you know this. The story of Jesus and Nicodemus. John 3. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with them. Jesus answered, so this is, how would you answer this? I'd probably start by saying, Nicodemus, I'm really glad that you recognize I'm such a good teacher. Thank you. But he says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. He just drops a grenade into this conversation, doesn't he? One statement, boom. So he's saying, Nicodemus, I think you're not going to make it to heaven. Nicodemus is saying, I think you're a good teacher. And Jesus says, I don't think you're going to make it to heaven. And then what you find is the rest of the conversation is the unwinding of Nicodemus's tension. Wait, do I have to go back in my mother's womb? Well, I don't understand this. And all of a sudden, Nicodemus is in high learning mode. And it's like Jesus wound up the clock, and that spring is just driving him forward as he learns. And that's one of the things that you capture people's attention. You know, sometimes we think people come into a room and they just are absolutely ready to listen to us. But most of the time, they're absolutely unready to listen to us. They're thinking about their day. They're tired from all the other things that were going on. They're finishing up. They've got their to-do list running in their head. And unless we capture their attention and pull it in, they may start listening halfway through if they start listening. And that's why Bruce said, students, if you've got a pen out and you're taking notes, put it down, because you're never going to forget what I'm going to say. He captured our attention. Here's another thing that he did. Jesus began with a statement. There's just the explanation that I already said. Tension to make them think. The Emmaus Road, oh my. This is just such an amazing story. When you put yourself in the shoes of those disciples and think of the irony of what's going on. Luke 24. So they're walking along, and then this Jesus drew near, and he said to them, what's this conversation you're holding with each other as you walk? And they stood still looking sad. And one of them says, are you the only visitor who doesn't know the things that happened in these days? And he said to them, what things? Now, isn't this crazy? He's just, what things? He could say, hey, guys, is Jesus, like it's done. Oh, what things? And then they said, oh, there's this Naz guy from Nazareth. We thought he was a mighty prophet, but then they deliver all this. And then he says, oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that Christ should suffer these things and enter his glory? And you just see him, he's just poking them the whole way. And then all of a sudden, you remember what he does at the very end, he breaks some bread and they go, boom. What an amazing story. What an amazing learning experience. They never, ever, ever forgot this. And wow, attention to make them think, because now they're having to think about what the prophets said. They're having to think about who Jesus was. And think about, did he really fulfill that prophecy even though he died? Attention to make help them remember. So John 21, we know this. Peter, do you love me? Yeah, you know, I really like you. Feed my sheep. Hey, Peter, do you love me? I mean, do you feel what Peter's feeling right now? You just asked me that question. Why are you asking me again? I answered you. I mean, this is not comfortable. This is not a comfortable conversation. Yeah, you know that I love you. Feed my lambs. Okay, I will. Hey, Peter, do you really love me? I've answered him twice. He's asking me the third time. And then he goes on and says, this is the death you're going to die. Follow me. And that commitment of Peter's to follow him is so important that he's willing to kind of crack this thing down and make Peter quite uncomfortable. Well, he is going to remember this forever. Tension. So when I learned to drive, my dad created this kind of tension. He grew up on a farm, and so he wanted me to learn to drive the same way he learned to drive, which I found out later why. But we went out to this field, and it was this old pickup. It had clutch and everything, so it was not an easy one. And I was 10 years old, and he showed me how to use a clutch, how to shift the gears, and jerked like this and all that. And he says, now watch real close what I do. And he says, I think you got it. And he got out and just shut the door and walked back home. I'll see you back at the farmhouse. and I had to find my way back on the roads and not run into any fences. And I remembered everything that he said, right? Because he created this tension environment for me to learn in, where I learned fast, and wow, never forgot that. And then I found out that his dad taught him to do that the same way. Well, we find that in movies or in the news, they use this as well. Do you ever notice how movies will always often start in the middle of the story? You know, something's blowing up, or something's falling, or someone's lost, and you don't know what's going on. And then it goes back to a quiet scene where they begin to, but you're still going, well, what was that? What was that explosion? Well, who was that person? That masked man, where did he come from? That's why they often tell stories out of order, because they have to capture you with the tension of the story, and then you'll listen to the rest. In the same way, books, if they don't capture you in the first couple paragraphs, have you ever picked up a book and started reading and then got mad at the author because you go, I really don't want to read this book. I don't want to read this book, but I have to finish it because I don't know what happened to that guy who got murdered in this first paragraph, or how does this love story end? So the news uses this. I was looking at my app for British news, and if you look at some of the titles, it's just it's really interesting. BBC. So here's some of the titles. You can see why. What is monkeypox, and how do you catch it? Why scientists are freezing threatened species. So tension to make them remember. Let's continue on. Here, by the way, is a comparison of the Sermon on the Mount and the different Czech sermons that I recorded. You can see the difference in the number of tension statements, about 46% of the whole sermon, and the number of tension statements in a typical sermon that I recorded in churches in my country, 4.3% or 1.4%. So what creates tension? Here's some things that create tension. Unresolved problems. The conflict between truth and life. The conflict between what I believe and how I act. I believe I should share my faith, but am I doing it? Opposing viewpoints. Can you leave lose your salvation or not? Let's hear from both sides. Wow, I hear people who disagree with each other. What do I do with that? Unanswered questions. Unfinished stories. Have you noticed that I didn't really finish my story at the beginning of the... Are you wondering if you'll ever find out what he preached on and what he said? Yeah. Yeah, maybe he will sometime. I don't know. But unfinished stories are great. It's a great way actually to start a story and get halfway through and then leave it at the point where you need to unfold it more and then come back. But you use the tension of that unfinished story to capture their attention. Unwanted consequences. Danger. Potential reward. Embarrassment. Failure. Relationships, and love always produces tension. So if you find that's why movies, there needs to be a love story, right? And there's tension between kids and their dad, and there's some problem that they're trying to solve, and you'll watch the whole movie. How can our sermons have those kinds of plot lines that go through them, where we capture people's attention and then slowly unwind it as it goes through? Now, a couple things about tension. Must be optimal. Too much and people give up. Too little and they never get involved. I was teaching our staff about a week ago, and I was talking about dealing with conflict. And as an example, I told a story of a conflict I'd had the week before when someone called me up on the phone and said some things that really hurt me, and it got in an argument. And finally, I said, I just can't talk about this anymore, and I hung up the phone. And the story was about someone named Mark. And so I'm telling this story, and I'm feeling my emotion, like how I felt in the whole thing. It's creating a lot of tension. But what I didn't realize is everyone's trying to figure out which Mark in the room I'm talking about, because there were five Marks in the room. And as I'm talking, I'm motioning like this, and one of the Marks was right there, right where Robert is. And everyone was looking, does he mean that Mark? And I finally sat down, and one of my coworkers said, "Dave, are you talking about someone in this room?" I said, "No." He said, "Everyone thinks you are." And so I got up and I said, "I made up his name. It's not even, his name is not even Mark, and none of you know him." And there was this collective, in the room. I just over-tensioned them. You know, I was just playing out an argument in front of all of them, and they were feeling really bad for the Marks in the room. So don't put it up too high. It must lead somewhere. We never want tension just for tension's sake. We want to lead towards truth. We don't just want to say, "Oh, you know, there's lots of controversy in following Jesus. You know, God's really confusing. There are a lot of perspectives on this. Let's go home." You want that tension to lead somewhere. Jesus was always taking people somewhere with tension. He was moving them somewhere. We don't just want tension for tension's sake. And we normally don't have to create tension. It exists. Our task is to uncover it and use it. So we don't have to, it's there. It's in your life. It's in your church. It's in your family. It's in your day. So how do you uncover it and use it in some of your teaching? Okay, so everyone's sitting down there. They're really paying attention, and there was something else that was true with what he said, relevance. Until the why question is answered, the price is always too high. Why do I need to listen to you? Why do I need to learn this? Why is this important? And you have to show the relevance to my world and my life. Otherwise, it's just another piece of information that doesn't fit anywhere. So here's what Jesus did. Jesus responded to current problems, spoke directly to specific people, and applied his truth immediately to their lives. So back to Sermon on the Mount. So open your Bibles or your apps and look at Matthew chapter 5. We'll pick it up in 22. And 23, 5, 22 and 23. "But I tell you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." And let's keep going, actually. "So if you're offering your gift to the altar, remember that your brother has something against you. Leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift." Now, one of the things is, notice this, he's saying this, he's actually unfolding a movie. It's not just don't argue with people in general, but he's saying, as you're going to the altar, you remember that your brother has something against you. Leave your gift at the altar. So am I supposed to tie up the goat at the altar? Go be reconciled to your brother, then come back and finish giving your gift. Do you see how this kind of plays out as a movie in an environment that they know? So he's not just talking about a general principle, he roots it into their world. He also does this later in Matthew 6, 5 through 7. It says, "When you pray, you must not like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogue." So now you see the specificity, to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. "Truly I say to you, they've received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room," now he's got this application, "shut the door, and pray to your Father who's in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you." So you just watch the movie being played out. It's not just principles, but it's rooted right into life. So when you're talking with people, think how can you turn what you're saying into a movie that's rooted in their life? A couple years ago, I was speaking at a chapel at a college in the United States, and I knew that I was one of those many chapel speakers. Okay, why are they going to listen to me? They've been listening to things all day. I was supposed to speak on the will of God. So this is what I did. First, I looked and saw what events were going on in the college at that time and realized they'd just come back from fall break. So I started by saying, you just got back from fall break, didn't you? Did any of you spend any time with any relatives when you were on fall break? And some of them raised their hands. I said, did any of your relatives ask you some questions that were hard to answer? Like Aunt Wilma. You know, you were probably having a meal with your parents. Your Aunt Wilma comes over to your house and she sits down next to you and she says, Joey, you're back from school. And then she asks you a question. What question do you think Aunt Wilma is going to ask you at that point? What question do you think Aunt Wilma is going to ask? A college student who's home on break. Do you have a girlfriend? Isn't that just kind of that's going to be one of the questions. There's a couple other questions that will probably come up. Any other question you think? We have a girlfriend. Well, there's another one that's really good, too. Do you know what you do when you're going to do when you graduate?
Oh, yes.
Right? And then the other one is, have you decided on your major yet? That's the third one. And so then my question was, you're learning answers to all kinds of questions, but do you have some really, really important questions you don't have the answer to yet? Like, who should I marry? I mean, I know the valence numbers in chemistry, and I know, you know, these formulas in math, but I don't know who I'm supposed to marry. And I don't know what I'm going to do when I finish college, and I can't even decide on my major. Wouldn't it be great if God just told you? Like, you know, what would it be like if you're sitting in the dining room and all of a sudden a cloud comes and descends on the girl and you go, that's her. You know, it could be fire at night and a cloud during the day. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Or don't burn her hair, right? Or you're sleeping and all of a sudden there's a light in the room and there's an angel standing there and he tells you who you're supposed to marry. That's happened before. You know, why doesn't God do that to you? Or maybe God doesn't care and he just did that in the past. How do you find out God's will? Okay, now I'm also creating some tension. But you see how I'm rooting it in their life, making it relevant? Telling stories that like this, like the going to the temple, like he also talks about when you're shutting the door, standing on the street corner, and that it roots it in their setting in such a way that they can see exactly how this is going to happen. So he responded to current problems, and then he spoke directly to specific people. This is also really interesting. He said, I tell you. One of the things I found when I went through the typical sermons that are preached in churches across Czech Republic is that there is this holy we that we talk about. Do you know the holy we? Us believers, we often have problems with loving each other, and we need to learn to love each other more. We need to, and there's this we, and it's all quite general. We think we're committed to God, but we aren't committed enough because if we were, our neighbors would know. There's all these words, but they're all so general. The words are just so general. This holy generality, this holy we. And look at what Jesus does. This is pretty amazing if you look at the text. I tell you, just scan that, and I'm going to show you how many times you is in there. He's talking to people. He's talking to the people that are in front of him. He's not talking to general people all over. He is seeing the person that's there, almost using their name. You, your righteousness, you will never, I say to you. He's talking to the person who's in front of you. So are you talking in general to general people? Are you picturing faces? Do you know names? So that's why it's great to know that Stephen's there and Sarah's there and Robert's there and it'd be great if I knew a little bit about all of your situations so that as I'm applying whatever I'm teaching, I know that Laszlo teaches at, so I asked a couple of these questions. and let me see if I can remember. You teach at a church or a school too, don't you? Calvary Chapel, right? Okay. So it's good to find out some of these things so that if I'm even maybe giving application, I can, so like, in Calvary Chapel with that school that you guys have and make that application specifically to that setting. So spoke directly to specific people, and then here's another section. Take a look at the you. Now, it doesn't have to be you like this. It can be you in very compassionate ways, like when I know that Stephen has served in France for 30 years and I think about that faithfulness and what it means to still be in the trenches there and can think about him teaching and being equipped. So it's the you can be, can it doesn't have to be like this. It can be like when Jesus saw Nicodemus, how did you know me? I saw you standing under the tree. But it does, that's the holy we, and the holy generalities are quite common in our preaching. Sometimes I have to go through back through my notes and actually edit the "we" out, because I go, am I talking? I could talk about me. I could talk about I have a problem with this, or I could talk about, but the "we" kind of, who am I talking to? Oh, he used you. So that's an interesting one. Well, and here's the last one. Applied his truth immediately to their lives. So there's this application that's, again, not a general application. 5:39-42. And this, I've been quoting this a couple times. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other one also. Boy, this is really specific. If anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. And so, do you see how his kind of gradation application? He's not just saying, when people are mean to you, be nice back. No, really, we often are not nice to people who are mean to us. We often are mean back. But we need to learn, like Jesus, to be nice, to have our hearts full of love. Do you see how general everything I'm saying is? But when he says, hey, if somebody slaps you, what are the specifics? How can you make it come alive in your application to where someone could actually picture that application? They could do it through a story of you applying that in some way, or they could go, what would happen if in this situation you did this? He was... really applied it. So what you see is with his relevance, he comes from problems, speaks to specific people, and makes immediate application back to their life. So that's that kind of from their life to the person, back to their life with his truth. And because of that, the truth just penetrates and just goes right in. Now you'll see in your notes here, it takes, when I first did this study, I did it in 1997, and at that point it took 8 years for the information in the world to double. The conservative estimates now are 13 months. So you just think of all the information that's coming at people, and because of that, we have sophisticated systems designed in our brain to discard information. And so if you don't show people why what you're saying is relevant, it will just pass. They will not remember it. So show them the relevance as you go. Otherwise it's just going to get put in the heat. Here it is. Same doubling happens in 13 months. Every day we get bombarded. Expensive, sophisticated attempts to get our attention. And we have these unconscious filters. So here is my comparison of... By the way, these sermons were done by really excellent people who are considered in the Czech church to be really good preachers. And you can see Jesus mentions 46 specific problems, and one sermon mentioned one specific problem, another one four, the last one zero. Number of times he says you or your, 85, 5:33, and specific statements of application, do this, 40. And in one sermon there was zero, another sermon there was zero, another sermon there was just one. Okay, so time's up. We'll keep going tomorrow, and we'll go a little bit farther into James tomorrow and continue on three more secrets. So you guys have done a great job of interacting and digging in.